I want to introduce everyone to Midwest Natives Nursery. They have done such a wonderful job at providing affordable Nebraskan and regionally native plants and delivering them to our doorstep. We couldn't be happier with the quality of Nathan's plants for a nominal price per pot. And I just love finding those native plants on my wish list that I can't source anywhere else. Located in Lincoln, Nebraska, Midwest Natives specializes in the sustainable cultivation of perennial wildflowers and grasses native to the Great Plains. They strive to provide the highest quality, healthiest, and pesticide-free plants to homeowners wanting to protect and promote pollinators and wildlife in their own backyards. Their selection of locally grown and non-cultivar natives is the largest in Nebraska, making them your one-stop shop for plants that will thrive in any landscape situation. From ground covers to prairie giants, from standing water to bone-dry soil, from full sun to full shade, and with blooms spanning spring to fall in every color and shape you can imagine, you can be sure that Midwest Natives has the best plants for you, your landscape, and the environment around you. Kick off your 2024 growing season with a bang by joining Midwest Natives at their spring opening day sale in Lincoln on Saturday, May 4th. For more information, recommended plant lists, and other helpful guides, visit their website today at www.midwestnativesnursery.com. This is a special call to action to our listeners to financially support this podcast and spread awareness of the Native Plants Dialogue through exclusive Plant Native Nebraska merch at plant-native-nebraska.myspreadshop.com. Wear our designs in your best effort to convert your friends and neighbors, or just simply look cool. Thank you for your continued support in our quest to help Nebraska plant native. Hello, and welcome to the Plant Native Nebraska podcast. I'm your host, Stephanie Barlman. If you are new to tuning in, this show is for native plant enthusiasts, aspiring gardeners, suburban homeowners, growers, and thinkers anxious to learn more about growing Native American plants and creating habitat for wildlife. If this sounds like you, you've come to the right place. In today's episode, The Modern Botanist, we examine what modern gardening can look like within the native plants framework, different tools you can use to get specced out in your gardening abilities, and why it matters more than ever to bring back gardening as part of a healthy lifestyle. Thanks for listening. A big part of gardening could be growing your own plants. The gardener gets to choose how many seeds to sow so it can be as tedious of a project as you design. What's especially cheerful about growing your own plants is getting lively little green sprouts in March and April, and we get our thrill for green things as a little mental jumpstart before the planting season even begins. Now, growing your own plants isn't rocket science. You can get as geeky about it as you'd like. I myself have not experimented with heat mats yet or doing too much about temperature control or even fertilizing like a pro. But start with a good potting soil. I got hooked on ProMix after seeing my friend's tomato plant starts looking very much heftier and healthier than mine. But another friend who is a professional grower told me about the Berger mix, so I'm experimenting around. You can even Google how to make your own potting soil and mix the components up in a wheelbarrow. It's fun to experiment and find what works better for us. Certain plants may do better in a sandier mix, like butterfly weed. This is a good place to experiment and flex that botany muscle. You're going to want to pre-moisten your soil in a tub trug or wheelbarrow or even a 5-gallon bucket. Make sure you turn it with a spade or some sort of gardening tool until it's well moistened. Whoever doesn't like the word moist is having a lot of fun right now. You can spend a bit more on seed trays that will hold up better to yearly use. I use Bootstrap Farmer watering trays, cell trays, and their humidity domes. But you can experiment around with whatever brand you can afford or what is available locally. Some people even cut down yogurt containers and drill a few holes in the bottom and place those and do some sort of old baking tray or another tray with a wide rim for bottom watering. If you don't already know what bottom watering is, you can get a narrow mouth watering can and pour water into a tray your filled cell trays or containers are sitting in. It's a great way to make sure the soil is getting nice and moist without washing out your seeds. I bottom water about once a week with humidity domes, and that's just because the domes help hold in the moisture. Only water when the soil is starting to dry out. If you overwater, you can get root rot. But okay, we need to talk about filling the trays and containers. Make sure you take that pre-moistened soil and really pack those cells. I like to take handfuls of soil and try to just spread it out over the tray. I do that over and over again until they seem pretty full to the eye. I then press down on each cell to see which ones need more added, likely all of them. And you really want to tamp in the cell more. Follow the directions on the seed packet for planting depth. Rule of thumb is usually the very teeny tiny seeds are going to need light to germinate, so you will just scatter those on the surface, and the bigger seeds will need to be planted something like a fourth of an inch down in the cell. For the seeds that will be planted in the soil, make sure to pre-drill your holes with a chopstick, an old pencil, or even just your fingertip. Put 2 to 3 seeds in each hole to try to ensure better germination. Cover the seeds by brushing over a little soil from one side of the cell and label each row. Pencil writing on a popsicle stick becomes illegible after getting wet soil on it. Marker runs. So what I've been doing is using my Brother label maker and making one stick with one label at the top for each row and then affixing the label with clear packaging tape to the stick. I'm hoping that this year this will help keep my labels more waterproof, and also it's cheap enough to not break my pocketbook. When you give plants away or you need to label each pot, just go ahead and use pencil on a popsicle stick for short-term labeling. Keep those plants happy. Pot up to a 3 or a 4 inch pot when you see true leaves. You can also start fertilizing once you pot up. You will have to Google fertilizing because it is something I am still mastering, and I'm trying not to over-fertilize as much as possible to kind of keep that sustainable, organic vibe going on. But most importantly, don't forget to harden off your plants before planting them out in the garden. Google is your friend at this point. If you make it here on your first year, you're doing really well. So that's my TED Talk on growing. Now, when it comes to planting is a whole nother ball game. You don't have to grow your own plants, but certainly get out and plant some. My friend tells everyone who will listen to buy a soil knife, they are really handy. So I'm going to pass along that she really thinks you all need one. You can also buy an auger attachment for your cordless drill or use a trusty drain spade for planting. Between those three tools, you've pretty much got planting covered. When you are planting, the soil level of the potted plant should sit about a half inch below the surface of the ground. If the plant seems pot-bound, you're going to want to tease some of those roots with your fingertips or give it a good slice horizontally and then again vertically. Don't be shy. The roots will recover and spread out instead of smother the plant. Lots of plants die from getting root bound. Don't forget to water the plants in and tamp down with the heel of your foot or by putting firm pressure all around the perimeter with the palms of your hands or really putting weight into your fingertips. Cover with more soil until we've got an upright plant well packed in the ground. And learn your plants. Plant taller plants in the middle or behind shorter ones. Line your paths with very short plants, think 6 to 12 inches or less. And yes, have paths. You're going to need paths to walk through and weed your garden. And it's going to be nice being able to cut through your garden so that you can get closer to observing pollinators and smelling the roses, if you will. Know and plant your ground covers. Strong shade ground covers native to Nebraska include wild ginger, May apple, and common violets. Some good ground covers for partial sun could be Virginia waterleaf or heartleaf aster. For our sun-crowned gardens, you can experiment around with different flowering ground covers like pearly everlasting, common violets, prairie blue-eyed grass, wild strawberry, wild geranium, wild petunia, or nearly native early buttercup Prairie Penstemon or Prairie Smoke. I also like the Snow Flurry cultivar of Heath Aster because it makes an excellent late blooming ground cover that pollinators love. You can also work in grass or sedge ground covers like Pennsylvania sedge, ivory sedge, long-beaked sedge, blue grama, buffalo grass, purple love grass. There's just so many great ground covers to choose from. Little Blue Stem also makes an excellent ground cover when planted en masse. Now on to lawning. A lot of us still have some amount of lawn to work with, as a large lawn may be a real chore to be rid of completely. But hope is here. We can lawn better. In regards to mowing, you can set your mower to the tallest setting and mow once a month. You can add in low-growing natives like self-heal, purple poppy mallow, common violets. You can add in plugs of sedges. And you can also choose to not spray exotic dandelions, henbit, clover, oxalis, or creeping charlie. If you insist on aerating and overseeding your lawn, you can simply overseed with buffalo grass or blue grama instead. If you have a really blotchy lawn in shady areas, you can even look into shade ground covers we mentioned before, or try your hand at a moss lawn. There's also a great bee lawn mix by Prairie Legacy that you can try to make a meadow lawn with or use in your house strip. Look, I'm of the mind that any reduction in mowing, pesticides, herbicides, and heavy fertilizers, and any increase in native and nectar or pollen providing plants is a win for wildlife, and also much more interesting for humans to look at. Reduce your lawn by planting garden borders. Start small and work as your free time and budget allows. In regards to weeding and managing, get out and weed monthly. Know your weeds, maybe let some go that don't get too tall or aren't super problematic. The oxalis, it isn't worth weeding. To me, the dandelion isn't worth weeding either, considering all parts of the plant are quite useful and they never get taller than 12 inches. You could always harvest some. I hand pull creeping charlie a few times a year from the garden, but not from the lawn because there's just so much in there. I would never get it all out. Creeping charlie is allelopathic, which means it inhibits the growth of surrounding plants. So it's useful to rid this one so your garden can get better established. There's an article I should mention by Better Homes and Gardens I use to identify common weeds. I recommend this to people, though I don't recommend using herbicide ever, so I just ignore those bits of the article. The link for that article is in today's show notes. You can decide the ones you can live without and hand pull them. And just know, perfection isn't possible, and pretty much every successful garden ever has had its share of weeds here and there. Know your weeds. Know which ones are problematic, okay? Know when to manage your plants that self-seed. This may involve culling some seedlings, transplanting plants to a different location, or cutting specific plants back after flowering to keep them from taking over a garden space. So this may include your agastache, tall boneset, coneflower, varieties of aster, pitcher sage, or sweet black-eyed Susan. Know your truly invasive or undesirable exotic and weedy plants. So we're talking calorie pear, Japanese honeysuckle, Canada thistle, brome, hops, foxtail, poison hemlock, all the really not fun stuff you don't want to have in your garden. Focus on keeping those out and let some of the stuff slide that's really not going to be noticed by anybody. On to observing. Get out and look at your garden. Take pictures in different seasons. Take pictures of blooming plants. Take pictures of what works. Maybe you get that garden journal going that you've put on the back burner for a while. Gardening broadens our realm of personal experience, which becomes observing, immersing, learning, experimenting, curating, and enjoying. But humans are such visceral creatures, right? So observing is that first initial step we take on this path towards experience. Observing provides us the thought opportunity to actively participate in the dance. When it comes to experimenting, I like to stress that we avoid the temptation to fall back into these rigid, unsustainable systems of traditional gardening. And there's these what I call mind traps that are even sometimes taught by your garden veteran, okay? So your run-of-the-mill garden experts sometimes have some problematic teachings, you know? Not everybody is perfect, and people can be opinionated. And I am just encouraging you to push back on some of these mind traps or quote-unquote garden myths, okay? One is that you must water constantly all year long. This is more of a traditional gardening myth. You do not have to water constantly all year long. It's kind of encouraging your plants to be little babies and rely on you so they have shorter root systems because they don't have to go very far for water. It makes plants weaker. Obviously, for plants that like drier soil, they are not going to be very happy and do very well if they get overwatered. Another myth is that you must never ever use non-native species. So this is more of a myth perpetuated by native plant purist type people. There's a lot of non-native species, and we don't talk about it a lot on the podcast, but there are a lot of non-native species that can coexist very happily in a native plant majority garden. So there's calamintha, or maybe you have some zinnias or Mexican sunflower that are actually in the range of our monarch. So something that the monarchs like to forage, but maybe not necessarily native to our area. There's different caveats that we can make for different plants that pollinators really do love. And, you know, also remember that we are a species that interacts with our environment. So if there's a plant that makes you really happy, well, that plant is for you. This is also your habitat. So it's a myth that you can never have an ethical garden unless you use 100% native species. It's just not true. And to be fair, it's not realistic. Another myth is that you must weed weekly. You must weed weekly to appease the aesthetic gods and HOAs and code enforcement. And that's a lot of weeding. And unless you did something crazy like plant into tilled turf grass like 5 days ago, you are not going to have to weed that often. You're going to want to plant densely. You're going to want to use ground covers. You can do an initial dusting with fine mulch to help prevent weed seeds from germinating. And a little bit of weeds here and there is okay. And you go to any beautiful garden on a garden walk, chances are here and there, if you look really close, you're going to find some weeds because we live on planet Earth and a completely sterile landscape is not realistic. Unless you're, you know, sterilizing everything with chemicals, you're going to have some weeds. And so it's okay. Another myth is that you must always use foundation plants. I do see the value in using foundation plants. I think from a design perspective, you know, there's some value there aesthetically to have things that are evergreen. When we're talking about like creating windbreaks for our house, those are all valid points, but it's a myth that you must use foundation plants. It's just a preference. It's just an idea. There's a lot of merits to the idea, but you don't have to plant evergreen boxwoods and hedge type plants all around the perimeter of your house. You can, you know, you're a homeowner, this is your property, and it's just a design aesthetic. So you can choose to follow a different design aesthetic. Another myth is that you must never use aggressive species. I've been told not to plant partridge pea, I've been told not to plant goldenrod, I've been told not to plant wild mint. That's another one that people have told me not to plant. I've been told not to plant native sunflowers or the thicketing native roses. And that's again, someone's preference to not use aggressive species. And people like to equate aggressive with invasive. And invasive means something that's coming in. So like a foreign exotic plant from Japan that is planted here and it starts taking over native habitat. That's what invasive is. Aggressive is something that's just an opportunist. It's a wild type growing plant. So it's going to spread, it's going to send out rhizomes or runners, and it's going to want to colonize. But that doesn't make it invasive. So I like to use these opportunists, if you will, in certain areas that I know I need a little bit of extra help with. For example, if you have a back corner and you're not quite sure that you're going to get back there to weed as often as you do other parts of your garden, or maybe you've got a hillside that's particularly laborious to weed, you can use these plants, their natural growing habits, and use that for your benefit. We're not following this absolutist, these are a list of good plants and these are a list of bad plants. It's all about planting for your space, planting for your needs, as your time is going to allow, as your budget is going to allow, and being realistic. There's also a myth to not have a wild front garden. So people are really stressing, well, if you want to have a wild garden, save it for the back. And I just think, let's go for it, right? Like, no, let's put it out there. We're not going to convert anybody by hiding our gardens in our backyard. We're going to convert people by putting something out for them to see so they understand, oh, well, this is like a really cool native garden. Wow, I didn't realize that they could be so pretty. We've got a showcase. Also, another myth is that you must keep lawns for negative space. So there's this design concept that talks about lawns as this kind of balance that balances out chaoticness of the garden space. You don't have to keep lawns for negative space, okay? Again, this is all artful, aesthetic preference. So everyone has their preferences. Okay, I like chocolate ice cream. You like strawberry ice cream. Just because you don't like chocolate ice cream doesn't mean that you're wrong. It just means that you prefer what you prefer and I prefer what I prefer. So you don't need to keep your lawn. There's no aesthetic god with a list of commandments that says you must keep lawns for negative space. Okay, you don't have to. If you decide to keep a lawn for negative space and you like that concept, you can always make a bee-friendly lawn. Or you can use any of those tips we talked about when we were talking about how to lawn better. Also, another myth is that you must not let anything go to seed. This is a more traditional gardening myth. So when everything is done flowering, you deadhead everything, you cut off the top growth of everything, don't let anything go to seed. And we can do that to manage spaces selectively if there's certain plants that are going to seed around a lot. We talked about the agastache and the coneflowers. If you're like, hey, this gets overwhelming to pull all these seedlings out every year, go ahead and cut that plant back when it's done flowering. You don't have to cut it all the way to the ground, but just cut off the tops. Just cut off the seed heads, or what's going to become the seed heads when it's done flowering. That's all you have to do. So again, there's not this rigid system of rules. The rigid systems of rules are pretty much like a human construct, right? And what we are trying to construct is something that's more realistic, something that's more sustainable, something that's kinder to the environment. So we can create new constructs. Okay, on to engaging and harvesting. Gardens tie us to time and place. They raise our seasonal awareness. We don't lose seasonal succession with native plants, but what seasonal succession looks like changes. Instead of going through a cascade of traditional and exotic plant bloom times like peony, iris, forsythia, we instead learn how to engage our senses and minds seasonally with regionally native plants. So in April, we see common violets blooming, early buttercup, field pussy toes, pasque flower, prairie smoke, which is a regional native, wild strawberry. Right now, it's April 10th. These are all blooming in my garden. Moving on to May, you start to see the penstemons bloom, blue-eyed grass, columbine, Canada anemone, golden Alexander starts pushing out. in the woodland areas, we get Jack in the Pulpit, we get May Apple, our Virginia Waterleaf, Purple Poppy Mallow might start blooming. Moving on into June and July, August and September and October, we have all these different plants beginning and ending, and a new plant is beginning and ending, and then a new plant is beginning and ending. And it's a really wonderful thing. It's just as wonderful as the traditional gardening bloom times that you might be used to, like first the forsythia blooms, and then the daffodils bloom, and then the tulips bloom, and then the iris bloom. And it's the same concept. We're just trading out the showcase of fireworks for different fireworks. In the sense of the new American garden, we become aware of local wildlife. We become aware of birds, pollinating insects, small mammals, amphibians. So much wildlife that we can observe once we start reintroducing spaces for habitat. The house and garden become a marriage of minds. The garden unifies home and habitat, and we achieve this strange, but at the same time, very natural unity with nature. The modern botanist is engaged with seasonal, edible, medicinal, and natural plant materials to be foraged from the garden. So whether you're digging up Jerusalem artichoke tubers or foraging redbud blossoms or harvesting rattlesnake master blades for basket weaving, the options are almost nearly endless in the pharmacopoeia of your design. When it comes to showcasing, we can use clues to show that we are creating and maintaining planned landscapes. We can get the public on our side and turn our private property into demonstration gardens. One way we can do this is by using signage. Physical signage can help highlight the intention of your garden to your neighbors. You can source signs from the Monarch Waystation Registry Program, Prairie Moon Nursery, Nebraska Monarchs, Midwest Natives Nursery in Lincoln, PATH, which stands for Pollinator Alliance of the Heartland. You can source them from Xerxes Society, and there's many other signs locally and online you can choose from. Another thing you can do is weed a little and plant heavily. So if you can't make time to weed often, we talked about weeding heavily once per month during the growing season. But plant the area as densely as possible. Cut the plant's width in half for planting distance. So if you are planting, say, a perennial, and it says that that perennial flower gets 2 feet wide, you're going to divide that in half. And when you plant that next perennial plant, say it's a penstemon, okay, and you've got a group of 5 penstemon that are going to go in your garden. If it says something like this penstemon gets to be 2 feet wide, you're going to plant those on 1 foot centers. Honestly, most perennials you're going to plant on 1 foot centers, unless if it's like a shrub or just some plant that gets outrageously wide. Like obviously elderberry, you're not going to plant elderberry on 1 foot centers. Whatever it says online or in a book that you read or on a tag or some sort of label for the plant, just cut that in half and then you know how to space that plant out. Another clue that we can use to show people that we are designing a planned space is think about framing. We talked about using paths in our gardens. You can edge your gardens with paths. You can use edgers such as bricks or cut crisply into the lawn. Use flowing graceful lines to make it easier on the eye and on the portions of lawn that you still have to mow. And another thing we can do is utilize design concepts when we can. So we can plant a variety of colors. We can plant for a variety of seasons. We talked about planting taller plants toward the back or the middle, and bringing the shorter plants to the front or alongside the edges. And we can also use plants for focal points. Also, one thing we just talked about is planting in drifts. So instead of isolating every plant, you can isolate some plants as a focal point, or maybe there's a few plants that are really happier growing solo. And then a lot of plants just plant in groups of 3 or 5 or 7. And you really get the maximum impact when you're thinking of insects that are foraging for pollen and nectar, because everything they're looking for is very close to them. But also you get the maximum impact when we talk about aesthetics, or really being able to see a plant in the garden and not having a plant get hidden by the things around it. You can also display your garden on a local garden walk. You can be a quasi-activist and get on a map of some kind. HomegrownNationalPark.org has a map, and Pollinator Alliance of the Heartland is working on a map right now, so you can get on the path map when it becomes available. Another thing we can do, and this might be the more controversial thing, is we can talk our friends to death about native plants, okay? So whenever you go to the zoo, or you go out to a botanical garden, or you go on some sort of nice nature hike, just bore everyone to tears just talking about the plants. Strangers, really anyone who will listen. This is how we really are gonna bring back gardening into the social dialogue, okay? I'm half serious here, but we're really gonna bring back gardening as a lifestyle choice by participating and showcasing and creating and living it. Moving on to researching and compiling, this is kind of an important part of positioning ourselves as modern botanists. Find out what's native to your area, and then plant what you like. So there's different tools in the show notes that we've recommended every episode. Boneapp.net, NWF.org, Plant Finder. There's different eco guides. So you can go on to pollinator.org and look at the different guides that they have for your region. You can go to xerxes.org, and they have pollinator-friendly plant lists on their website. And also our native plant group, Bellevue Native Plant Society, if you go to bellevuenativeplants.org, you can also find helpful resources there. You can look at plant catalogs for inspiration. Stock Seed, Prairie Moon, Prairie Nursery. Even magazines like Garden Gate have been focusing more on native gardens lately. You can also check out some great books for inspiration. We have some great books in our show notes that we've recommended for a while now by Heather Holm, Doug Tallamy, and other authors. Make a Pinterest board. Make a Pinterest board of good ideas. Sketch some ideas out, or find some free garden designs you like. One thing I tell people is just go onto Google and Google Prairie Moon Garden Designs. You'll find a lot of really awesome designs that don't cost any money. And then you can go grow some of the plants yourself, or you can find them locally, and you don't have to think very much about it. Also, get to know your local and online native plant suppliers. Prairie Moon Nursery is based in Minnesota, but they sell online plants and seed. Prairie Nursery is based in Wisconsin, but they sell online plants and seed. Prairie Legacy is based in Nebraska, and they sell both plants and seed, and they are local ecotype. Stock Seed is in Nebraska, and you can get some native seed from them. You can get plants from Great Plains Nursery in Nebraska. Midwest Natives Nursery in Nebraska is a sponsor for today's episode. Nathan has awesome plants, which I'm sure you heard in the advertisement at the very beginning. I'm very excited for the opening day sale. For example, I talked about early buttercup maybe a few times today. I really need more of it, so that's going to be one of the ones that I'm fighting you guys for. Another place locally that you can get native plants is from the Nebraska Statewide Arboretum. They have a spring affair event coming up that I hope to be at this year. Golden Hills RCND is a place in Iowa that's pretty close to us that you can get plants from. But all in all, transitioning from being a houseplant killer to a modern botanist really just requires diligence and patience and kind of like that kind, empathetic pat on the back when maybe we overwater a whole tray of something and it all gets root rot. And we're like, shucky darn it, you know? And we dust ourselves off and we say, that's okay. Because, you know, a lot of scientists accomplish great things, but they fail a lot in the very beginning. And they fail a lot in the middle. And they fail a lot all the way through being a scientist. And, you know, failing is how we learn. So being a modern botanist is is a lesson to be forgiving to yourself and to celebrate success when we find it. And also just fostering a strong connection with our natural environment, being inspired by it, experimenting with growing or arranging, just examining, just being there in it, observing. You don't have to get super nerdy about stuff. I mean, a lot of us do because we're insane. And so we get really nerdy about stuff and we know the Latin names for things. And maybe we're figuring out how to exactly pronounce the Latin names, or we can tell you, oh, this plant is actually related to that plant, or this plant actually is endemic to the sandhills, okay? And, you know, we can get really, really nerdy about stuff. We can tell you that, well, this kind of coreopsis can make native dyes, and this milkweed is fragrant, and you know, we start collecting all these little facts and tidbits from the garden. But to be a botanist, to be a modern gardener, just requires you to be present and you to be engaged with your garden. And you don't have to be an expert. You don't have to be a rocket scientist. You can make a lot of mistakes. You can make a lot of stupid mistakes. My goodness, have I made a lot of stupid mistakes in the garden. Or I do that thing where I go and I buy plants that I don't really have time to plant, and I don't really have time to water them, and they sit in a tray for a while and they get cooked. And I'm like, yeah, that was really dumb. So make mistakes and do your best. And you know what? Give yourself a little slack, because we're all super busy. We're all hyperextended. We're all overwhelmed. We live in a crazy world. And that little bit that you end up doing, it's enough. So I hope today was inspiring for everyone. I hope maybe you took away something that you didn't know before, or maybe you took away something that, well, I never really thought about it that way, or, oh, that's a new way of looking at it. And just remember that gardens are only, a beautiful garden is only possible if we plant a garden. So get planting. Thank you for tuning in to the Plant Native Nebraska podcast. If you need notes on anything mentioned in today's episode, check our website, plant-native-nebraska.captivate.fm for more info. I want you to know you've made this podcast special just by listening in, but if you found real value in today's talk, you can both financially support future episodes and dive deeper into the topics we share by finding us on Patreon at patreon.com/plant-native-nebraska. Thanks for listening. I want to give a special thanks to our friends at Midwest Natives Nursery, who have graciously sponsored today's episode.